pleasure to be here. I've come to the conclusion that the first need of black power is to rid white snow. I'm going to read an article which I did for the Massachusetts Quarterly Review, which appeared in their Fall 66 issue. It deals with the theoretical and philosophical concept of black power. It attacks the concept of integration as a route to allowing black people to get their liberation in this country. And it also attacks the concept expounded upon by the exponents of the coalition theory, notably Mr. Rustin, and then outlines programmatically a political program for black power. When we have the question and answer period, I know it's really impossible for people to deal with the content of what I say. So they usually ask inane questions about, do you hate white people? Do you want to tear up the country? Why are you so full of hate? If people could understand that in SNCC we're articulating a political philosophy, and if they could deal with that rather than ad hominem attacks, maybe the discussion could be fruitful. But I've learned that the American society is incapable of dealing with realities. One of the most pointed illustrations of the need for black power as a positive and redemptive force in a society degenerating into a form of totalitarianism is to be made by examining the history of distortion that the concept has received in the national media of publicity. In this debate, as in everything else that affects our lives, blacks are dependent on and at the discretion of forces and institutions within the society which have little interest in representing us honestly. Our experience with the national press has been that where they've managed to escape a meretricious special interest in get whitey sensationalism and race warmongering, individual reporters and commentators have been conditioned by the developing racism of the society to the point where they are incapable even of objective observation and reporting of racial incidents, much less the analysis of ideas. But this limitation of vision and perception is the inevitable consequence of the dictatorship of definitions, interpretation, and conscience, along with the censorship of history that this society has inflicted upon blacks and consequently upon itself. Our concern for black power readdresses itself directly to this problem, the necessity to reclaim our history and our identity from the cultural terrorism and depredation of self-justifying white guilt. To do this, we shall have to struggle for the right to create our own terms through which to define ourselves and our relationship to the society, and to have these terms recognized. This is the first necessity of a free people and the first right that any oppressor must suspend. The white fathers of American racism knew this instinctively, it seems, as is indicated by the continuous record of the distortion and omission in the chronicle of their dealings with the red and black men. A good example of that would be the westerns that we see on the Idiot Box. You know. There's a fight going on between the Indians and white folks, and the Indians are winning, so they send for the cavalry. Here comes the cavalry, all proper, riding astern. They just got out of riding class. And they shoot up all the Indians, and they return to the fort, and they say, "We had a victory today. We've killed all the Indians." And the women and the children run around and clap, and they kiss the lieutenant, and he rides away with the most beautiful chick. Now, when the reverse happens, when the Indians beat them up, you know, they come back to the fort dragging themselves, "Those dirty Indians, they massacred us today." Yeah. And see, that's very important, because a massacre is less honorable than is a victory. Everyone knows that, because the Indians used to kill them with knives, and the cavalry would kill the Indians with guns. And everyone knows that it's better to die by a gun than to die by a knife. So that because white people could define the terms of that, they define a massacre as something dirty, something foul. So the poor Indians couldn't win no matter how they tried. In the same way that the Southern apologists for the Jim Crow system which was established in the 1870s after any effort to reconstruct the South along lines of true political democracy was subverted, have so obscured, muddied, and misrepresented the record of that period so that it is almost impossible to determine what really happened. Their contemporary counterparts are busy doing the same thing with the recent history of the civil rights movement. In 1964, for example, the National Democratic Party, led by Lyndon Baines Johnson and his boy Wonder H. Humphrey, in the black community, we call H.H. Humphrey Handkerchief Head Humphrey. That's a despicable yes man. Did you see him on television during the State of the Johnson message to the country? I call it the State of the Johnson message because I've never seen a man quote himself three times from his speeches publicly. But every time Lyndon said something, my man, I'm like, in SNCC, we call them Batman and Robin because they run a camp government. But anyway, when Batman and Robin was leading the Democratic Party, they cynically undermined the efforts of Mississippi's black population to achieve some degree of political representation. I'm talking about the 1964 convention in Atlantic City when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the right of the regular Democratic Party at the National Democratic Party convention and was turned down. Yet, whenever the events of that convention are recalled by the press, one sees only that version fabricated by the press agents of the Democratic Party. A year later, the House of Representatives, in an even more vulgar display of political racism, made a hollow mockery of the political rights of Mississippi's blacks when it failed to unseat the Mississippi delegation to the House, which had been elected through a process which systematically excluded 450,000 voting-age blacks, almost one-half of the total electorate of that state. Yet, a month ago, they were able to displace Mr. Powell because he spent a lot of money with a lot of style. Whenever this event is mentioned in print, it is in terms which leaves one with the rather curious impression that somehow the oppressed black people of Mississippi are at fault for confronting the Congress with a situation in which they had no alternative but to endorse Mississippi's racist political practices. I mention these two examples because, having been directly involved in them, I can see very clearly the discrepancies between what happened and the versions that are finding their way into general acceptance as some kind of popular mythology. Thus, the victimization of black people in this country takes place in two phases. First, in fact and deed. And then secondly, and this is equally sinister, in the recording of those deeds. The Black Power program and concept, which is being articulated by SNCC, CORE, and a host of community organizations in the ghettos of the North and South, has not escaped that process. The white press has been busy articulating their own analysis, their own interpretations, and criticisms of their own creations. Now, I was a bit worried about that because when we first said Black Power, everybody came down against us and we couldn't figure out why. And I was reading George Bernard Shaw a couple of months later, and I came across a sentence which I thought was quite apropos. Mr. Shaw says, "All criticism is in fact an autobiography." For example, while the press had given wide and sensational dissemination to attacks made by the figures in the civil rights movement, foremost among which are Mr. Roy Wilkins of the NAACP and his counterpart Whitney Young of the Urban League, and to the hysterical rantings about black racism made by the political chameleon that now serves as vice president, it has generally failed to give accounts of the reasonable and productive dialogue which has taken place in the black community and in certain important areas in the white religious and intellectual community. A national committee of influential Negro churchmen affiliated with the National Council of Churches despite their obvious respectability and responsibility, had to resort to a paid advertisement to articulate their position, while anyone shouting the historical yappings of black racism got ample space. Thus, the American people have gotten at best a superficial and misleading account of the very terms and tenors of this debate. I wish to quote briefly from a statement by the National Committee of Churchmen. The statement was a paid advertisement which appeared in the New York Times on July 31st of last year. It was what I thought a very good statement. It was signed by about 150 black churchmen across the country. I wish to quote at length from it. I quote, "We, an informal group of Negro churchmen in America, are deeply disturbed about the crisis brought upon our country by historic distortion of important human realities in the controversy about black power. What we see shining through the variety of rhetoric is not anything new, but the same old problem of power and race which has faced our beloved country since 1619. The conscience of black men is corrupted because, having no power to implement the demands of conscience, the concern for justice in the absence of justice becomes a chaotic self-surrender. Powerlessness breeds a race of beggars. We are faced now with a situation where powerless conscience meets conscienceless power." I would like to repeat that phrase because I believe it is axiomatic to race relations in this country. We are faced now with a situation where powerless conscience meets conscienceless power, threatening the very foundations of our nation. We deplore the overt violence of riots, but we feel it is more important to focus on the real sources of these eruptions. These sources may be embedded inside the ghetto, but their basic cause lies in the silent and covert violence which white middle-class America inflicts upon the victims of the inner city. In short, the failure of American leaders to use American power to create equal opportunity in life as well as law, this is the real problem and not the anguish cry for black power. Without the capacity to participate with power, that is, to have some organized political and economic strength to really influence people with whom one interacts, integration is not meaningful. America has asked its Negro citizens to fight for opportunity as individuals, whereas at certain points in our history, what we have needed most has been opportunity for the whole group, not just for selected and approved Negroes. We must not apologize for the existence of this form of group power, for we have been oppressed as a group and not as individuals. We will not find a way out of that oppression until both we and America accept the need for Negro Americans, as well as for Jews, Italians, Poles, and white Anglo-Saxon Protestants to have, among others, and to wield group power. End of quote. Traditionally, then, for each new ethnic group, the route to social and political integration into America's pluralistic society has been through the organization of their own institutions with which to represent their communal needs within the larger society. This is simply what black power is all about. The strident outcry, particularly from the liberal community, that has been evoked by this proposal can only be understood by examining the historic relationships between black people and the white power structure in this country. Blacks are defined by two forces, our blackness and our powerlessness. There have been traditionally two communities in America, the white community, which has controlled and defined the forms that all institutions within the society would take, and the black community, which has been excluded from participation in the power decisions that shape the society and has traditionally been dependent upon and subservient to the white community. This has not been accidental. The history of every institution of this society indicates that a major concern in the ordering and structuring of the society has been the maintaining of the black community in its condition of dependence and oppression. This has not been on the level of individual acts of discrimination between individual whites against individual blacks, but as total acts by the white community against the black community. This fact cannot be too strongly emphasized, that racist assumptions of white superiority have been so deeply ingrained into the structure of the society that it infuses the entire functioning of this society and is so much a part of the national subconscious that it is taken for granted and is frequently not even recognized. Let me give an example of the difference between individual racism and what we in SNCC call institutionalized racism, and the society's response to both. Now, this is very, very important because I think white liberals focus their attention on individual acts of racism, and in SNCC, we focus ours on institutionalized racism. When unidentified white terrorists bomb a black church and kill 5 black children, that is an act of individual racism, widely deplored by most segments of the society, black and white. But when in that same city, Birmingham, Alabama, not 5, but 500 black babies die each year because of lack of proper food, shelter, and medical facilities, and 1,000 more black people are maimed and destroyed physically, emotionally, and intellectually because of conditions of poverty and deprivation in the ghetto, that is an act of institutionalized racism. But the society either pretends it doesn't know of this situation or is incapable of doing anything meaningful about it. And this resistance to doing anything meaningful about the conditions in the ghetto comes from the fact that the ghetto is itself a combination of forces and special interests inside the white community. And the groups that have access to the resources and power to change that situation benefit politically and economically from the existence of that ghetto. It is more than a figure of speech to say that the black community in America is the victim of white imperialism and colonial exploitation. This is in practical economic and political terms true. And for philosophy students, it would be called a truism. There are over 20 million black people comprising 10% of this nation. That's what they tell us. I think they're lying. I think we're more. They, for the most part, live in well-defined areas of the country, in the shanty towns and rural black belt areas of the South, and increasingly in the slums of northern and western industrial cities. If one goes into any black community, whether it be Jackson, Mississippi, Cambridge, Maryland, or Harlem, New York, one will find that the same combination of political, economic, and social forces are at work. The people in the black community do not control the resources of that community. Its political decisions, its law enforcements, its housing standards, even the physical ownership of land, houses, and stores lie outside that community. It is white power that makes the laws, and it is violent white power in the form of armed white cops that enforce those laws with guns and nightsticks. The vast majorities of blacks in this country live in these captive communities and must endure these conditions of oppression because, and only because, we are black and powerless. I do not suppose that at any point the men who control the power and resources of this country ever sat down and designed these black enclaves and formally articulated the terms of their colonial and dependent status, as was done, for example, by the apartheid government of South Africa, which this country supports. Yet one cannot distinguish between one ghetto and another. As one moves from city to city, it is as though some malignant racist planning unit had done precisely this, designed each one from the same master blueprint. And indeed, if the ghetto had been formally planned, rather than growing spontaneously and inevitably from the racist functioning of the various institutions that combine to make this society, it would be somehow less frightening. The situation would be less frightening because if these ghettos were the result of design and conspiracy, one could understand their similarity as being an artificial and consciously imposed upon quality. rather than the result of identical patterns of white racism which repeats itself in cities as distant as Boston is to Watts. Without bothering to list the historic factors which contribute to this pattern, economic exploitation, political impotence, discrimination in employment, education, one can see that to correct this situation will have far-reaching changes in the power relationships and the ingrained social patterns within the society. The question is, of course, what kind of changes are necessary and how is it possible to bring them about? In recent years, the answer to these questions, which had been given by a most articulate group of Negroes and their white allies, the liberals of all stripes, has been in terms of something called integration. According to the advocates of integration, social justice will be accomplished by, and I quote, integrating the Negro into the mainstream institutions of the society from which he has been traditionally excluded, end of quote. It is very significant that each time I've heard the formulation, it has been in terms of the Negro, the individual Negro, rather than in terms of the entire black community. This concept of integration had to be based on the assumption that there was nothing of value in the black community and that little of value could be created among black people. So the thing to do was to siphon off the acceptable Negroes into the surrounding white middle-class communities. Thus, the goals of the movement for integration was simply to loosen up the restrictions barring the entry of Negroes into the white community. Goals such as public accommodations, open housing, job opportunities on the executive level, around which the struggle took place, are quite simply middle-class goals articulated by a tiny group of Negroes who had middle-class aspirations. Now, I do believe that the press had quite a bit to do with that, because while we were waging our battles in the South in the early 60s, they were interpreting it for us. And I used to watch the editorial twins of America, Chuck and what's his other name? Huntley and Brinkley, you know. And they would say, Negroes were marching in Mississippi today. They were beaten down by Jim Clark's posse, run across the street, whipped, shot at, but they're still marching to integrate. Next day I'd see me say, Negroes are now joined by their northern Negroes from the north who have come down to help them march. Today they were beaten by Ross Barnett, cattle whipped, horse ran over them, but they're still marching to integrate. And then I decided, since I had a little work in logic and philosophy, that the logical conclusion of that was I left New York to come to Mississippi to sit next to Barnett's daughter or to hold hands with Jim Clark. Obviously, I never did that. I went to Mississippi and Alabama to render those crackers impotent over my life. Over my life. Over my life. Now, that is a big difference between integration. And this country could not admit that, because we were fighting against white supremacy. We weren't fighting to integrate with anybody. That's a big difference. And the country could not admit that, because to admit that, they would have to admit that they're white supremacists inside the home of the free and whatever nonsense who were in power. And so they said we were fighting to integrate. How nice. Though they may slay me, yet will I serve them. That's for us who are biblical in the in-group. This limited class orientation was reflected not only in the programs and goals of the civil rights movement, but by its tactics and organizations. It is very significant that the two oldest and most respectable civil rights organizations have I can only say three-fifths of that word.
I can handle one-fifth.
You can handle
it. That still leaves us another fifth.
What's the word there?
Well, constitutions, yes. I left off the fifth there on the event.
When I become five-fifths, I'll be able to say the whole word. Well, anyway, these organizations have those things which specifically prohibit partisan political activity. The Congress of Racial Equality once did, but changed that clause when it changed its orientation towards black power. But this is perfectly understandable in terms of the strategy and goals of our older organizations. The civil rights movement saw its role as a kind of liaison between the powerful white community and the dependent black one. The dependent status of the black community apparently was unimportant, since it was, if the movement was successful, going to blend into the white community anyway. We made no pretense of organizing and developing institutions of community power inside the black community, but in appealing to the conscience of white institutions of power. The posture of the civil rights movement was that of the dependent, the suppliant. The theory was that without attempting to create any organized base of political strength itself, the civil rights movement could be forming coalitions with various of the liberal pressure organizations in the white community, liberal reform clubs, labor unions, church groups, progressive civic groups, and at times one or the other of the major political parties. It could thus influence national legislation and national social patterns. I believe we've all seen the limitations of this approach. We have repeatedly seen that political alliances based on the appeals of conscience and decency are chancy things, simply because institutions and political organizations have no conscience outside their own special interest. The political and social rights of black people have been and always will be negotiable and expendable the moment they conflict with the interest of our so-called allies. If we do not learn from history, says the philosopher Sartre, we are doomed to repeat it. And that is precisely the lesson that we must learn from the Reconstruction period. Blacks were allowed to register, vote, and participate in politics because it was to the advantage of a powerful white ally to promote this, notably Tom Watson, that great liberal. But this was the result of a white decision, Tom Watson's decision. And it was ended by the same white man's decision, Tom Watson again. Before any political base powerful enough could be developed inside the Southern black community to challenge that decision. Thus, at this point in the struggle, blacks have no assurance save a kind of idiot optimism and faith in a society whose history is one of blatant racism, that if it were to become necessary, even the painfully limited gains thrown to the civil rights movement by the liberal Congress will not be revoked as soon as a shift in political sentiment should occur. The major limitations of this approach was that it tended to maintain the traditional dependence of blacks and of the movement. We depended upon the goodwill and support of various groups within the white community whose interests were not always compatible with ours. To the extent that we depended on the financial support of other groups, we were vulnerable to their influence and domination, as SNCC has come to find out. Also, the program that evolved out of this coalition was really limited and inadequate in the long term, and one which affected only a small group of selected Negroes. Its goal was to make the white community accessible to the qualified Negro, and presumably, each year, a few more Negroes armed with their passports, a couple of university degrees, would escape into white middle class America and adopt the attitudes and lifestyle patterns of that group. And one day, the Harlems and the Watts would stand empty, a tribute to the success of integration. This is simply neither realistic nor is it particularly desirable. You can integrate communities, but you assimilate individuals. Even if such a program were possible, its result would be not to develop the black community as a functional and honorable segment of the total society with its own cultural identity, life patterns, and institutions, but to abolish it, the final solution to black people's problem in this country.
Karl Marx reminds us that the working class is the only class that wants to abolish itself. If one were to listen very closely to some of our moderate Negro leaders, you would think that black people were the first people that wanted to abolish themselves. The fact is that what must be abolished is not the black community, but the dependent colonial status that has been inflicted upon it. The racial and cultural personality of the black community must be preserved, and the community must win its liberation while preserving its cultural integrity. This is the essential difference between integration as it is currently practiced and the concept of black power. And what has the movement for integration accomplished to date? That the Negro graduating from Michigan State with a doctorate will have better job opportunities available to her than even Linda Bird Johnson? But the rate of unemployment in the black community is steadily increasing, while that in the white community decreases. More educated Negroes hold executive-type jobs in major corporations and federal agencies than ever before, but the gap between white income and black income has almost doubled in the last 20 years. More suburban housing is available to Negroes if they can stand the rocks, but housing condition in the ghetto is steadily declining. That's Cicero. While the infant mortality rate of New York City is at its lowest rate ever in the city's history, the infant mortality rate of Harlem is steadily climbing. There has been an organized national resistance to the Supreme Court's order to integrate the schools, and the federal government has not acted to enforce that order. Less than 15% of black children in the South attend one-way integrated schools, and the vast majority of blacks who live in the South and in the North must still attend segregated black schools, which are still increasingly decrepit, overcrowded, understaffed, inadequately equipped, and funded. And this country tells us that we should focus our attention on the 15% because the 85% is expendable. You know, in order to get into a white school, if you're black and you're going to integrate, you have to be an A student. Did you know that? We can't send the worst of our race to represent us. You know. Besides, white people won't accept the bad ones. You've got to send the ones who they approve of. So they take our best, the best that we have in our schools, and send them to sit with animals whose parents throw rocks and bottles and cigarette butts at them while they walk up to come and sit next to their kids. That's integration in this country. And we just say we need the best with us. Let white society civilize itself. It's their problem. This explains they ought to bring their missionaries back from Africa and send them into their own schools. Teach them about love and Jesus Christ. If they ever taught him, though, they'd tear up this country because he was revolutionary. Dig it? This explains why the rate of school dropouts is increasing among black teenagers who then express their bitterness, hopelessness, and alienation in the only means they have through imitating this society via violence. As long as people in the ghettos of our large cities feel that we're the victims of the misuse of white power without any way to have our needs represented, we will continue to have rebellions. These are not the products of black power, but of the absence of any organization capable of giving the community the power, the black power, that it needs to deal with its problems. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee proposes that it is now time for the black liberation movement to stop pandering to the fears and anxieties of the white middle class America in an attempt to earn its goodwill, and to return to the ghettos to organize those communities to control themselves. This organization must be attempted in the northern and southern urban areas, as well as the rural black belt areas of the South. The chief antagonist to this organization is, in the South, the overtly racist Democratic Party, and in the North, the equally corrupt and just as racist big city machine. The standard argument presented against independent political organization is, but you are only 10%. I cannot see what the relevance of this observation is, since no one is talking about taking over the country, because God knows we wouldn't know what to do with this monster, but rather of taking control over our own communities. The fact is that black population or not, 10% or not, we have never been able to feel the true voting strength of our potential numbers. And that what is also important is that, ironically, because of segregation, we are strategically placed inside this country, where we could vote, whether we're white and liberal enough. The case has always been that the white political machines stacks and gerrymanders the political subdivisions in our communities so that the true voting strength is never reflected in political strength. Would anyone looking at the distribution of political power in Manhattan ever think that blacks represented 60% of the population there? And that has nothing to do with the Puerto Rican community with which we just hooked up. Just as often, the effective political organization in the black communities is absorbed by tokenism and patronage, the time-honored practice of giving certain offices to selected Negroes. The machine thus creates a little machine which is subordinate and responsive to it in the black community. These so-called Negro political leaders are really vote deliverers, more responsible to the white machine and the white power structure than to the community they allegedly represent. Thus is the white community able to substitute patronage control for audacious black power in the black community. This is precisely what LBJ tried to do even before the Voting Rights Act of 65 was passed. The National Democrats made it clear, crystal clear, that the measure was intended to register Democrats, not black people. The president and top officials of the Democratic Party called in almost 100 selected Negro leaders from the Deep South. Nothing was said about changing the policies of racist state parties. Nothing was said about repudiating such leadership figures as Eastland and Ross Barnett of Mississippi or George and Loreen Wallace of Alabama. What was simply said, and I quote, is go home and organize your people into the local Democratic Party, then we'll see about poverty money and appointments, my fellow American. We must organize black community power to end these abuses and to give the black community a chance to have its needs expressed, a leadership which is truly responsible not to the white press and power structure, but to the community must be developed. A leadership which will recognize that its power lies in the unified and collective strength of that community. This will make it difficult for the white leadership group to conduct its dialogue with individuals in terms of patronage and prestige, and will force them to talk to the community's representatives in terms of real black power. The single aspect, then, of the black power program that has come into the most criticism is this concept of independent political organization. This is presented as third partyism, which has never worked, or withdrawal into black nationalism, which leads to isolationism and therefore yields reverse racism. If such a program is done, it will not have the effect of isolating the black community, but the reverse. When the black community is able to control local offices and negotiate with other groups from a position of organized strength, the possibility of meaningful political alliances on specific issues will be increased. That is a rule of politics, and there is no reason why it should not operate here. The only difference is that we will have the power to define the terms of those alliances. The next question usually is, so, can it work? Can the ghettos, in fact, be organized? The answer is that this organization must be successful because there are no viable alternatives, not the war on poverty, which was at its inception limited to dealing with effects rather than causes and has simply become another source of machine patronage. Integration is meaningful only to a small chosen within the black community. The revolution in agricultural technology in the South is displacing the rural black community into northern urban areas. Both Washington, D.C. and Newark, New Jersey have black majorities. The inner city in most major urban areas are already predominantly black. And with the white rush to suburbia, blacks will in the next three decades control the heart of our great cities. These areas can become either concentration camps with a bitter population whose only power is the power to destroy, or organized and powerful communities able to make constructive contributions to the total society. Without the power, the black power, to control our lives and our communities, without effective political institutions with which to relate to the total societies, our communities will exist in a constant state of insurrection. This is a choice that this country will have to make. I want to thank you.
I have a feeling my presence here is somewhat anticlimactic, especially after our Bud Abbott and Lou Costello routine. However, my name is Jim Carbine, and I'm here on behalf of the Associated Students of Michigan State University who are financing the speech this afternoon and co-sponsoring it with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I can only pronounce three-fourths of that word. Pat Smith, who is the Michigan State president for this chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who put this on, has asked me to thank three groups, Alpha Kappa Alpha, Delta Sigma Theta, and Alpha Phi Alpha, who gave of their time to act as ushers and set up the physical facilities for this afternoon's program. I think they deserve a lot of credit. Well, now is. With as little time as we have left, move into a question and answer period. We'll have to cut it off when the time limit is up, so if anyone has any questions now, fire away. Well, here we have one down here.
Would you repeat them?
Yeah. You want him to repeat on the conversation he had with Saul Alinsky in Detroit?
I think that our politics vary. But as an organizer, I cannot deny the fact that he's been the one person in this country who's been in the black communities in the northern areas organizing. So that there are a lot of tactics maybe that I could pick up from him. But I think politically we disagree.
Okay. Did you catch that?
Yeah, the question is essentially is SNCC attacking the black bourgeoisie in its attempt to organize the slums. Is that correct analysis? No. All right, the question then is that SNCC has not yet come out to incorporate the black bourgeoisie to bring them into a political consciousness. Well, we started with, when you start a movement, a political movement, you start off with a broad, inclusive philosophy to try and get everybody. Now I think the black bourgeoisie as individuals have made it in this society, and that we cannot as yet focus our attention on them. We have to focus our attention more on the slum areas, because they represent the people who are willing to fight the hardest and the ones who you can really bring together into an organization for. That isn't to say that we neglect the black bourgeoisie. We do, in fact, do a number of things with them on the side, and we're hoping to slowly pull them in. But we can't focus all our attention on them just yet, because we feel in the long run, they're the ones who are brainwashed and must come home.
Does that get you?
In here in third row.
That's the first row. The question is, what relevance do you report to the White House report on the effect of the Negro family?
Yeah. Yeah, I got a thing about white folks talking about my mama playing the dozens with me, you know. And that's what that report was all about. I think that those white cats ought to function on white society and the disruption there. I think that the problems that we have are long and social problems, but that the effect, that the real effect comes from the outside community, the white community, which exploits and oppresses us, more than from internal, because we don't have any way to control anything that exists in our community so that they can program us so that that's what happens. I mean, that's the way they program us. They program us so we end up in Vietnam. And then they say, well, they can't find jobs. Of course they can't find jobs. They don't provide any. And then they tell you, well, the best way to enjoy life and equality is in the army on the front lines in Vietnam. That's because we're programmed that way, and that's precisely how white society has programmed the ghettos of this country. Because any black man in this country who has been aggressive must be castrated by white America, must be castrated. Check out your history. All the black men who were aggressive were lynched physically in the old days. Then you had the destruction of Du Bois, making it impossible for him to function in this country. Paul Robeson, Richard Wright, check them all out. Let us not talk about Marcus Garvey, let alone the death of Malcolm X. And then let's bring it down close to aggressive Mr. Powell. And finally, the greatest, Muhammad Ali.
That's all right. Their job.
Their job has always been to castrate aggressive black men so that the only people left would be the females. Then they turn around and blame us for it. If they wouldn't castrate us, we'd function.
Ron, did you ever? The question is, now that a definition of black power has been made, what do you feel is going to happen between the splits and between the various civil rights organizations?
Well, I don't think there's a split. I think that in all movements you have groups that vie for the ears of the masses. I mean, when Castro went to the hills, there were 9 cats who were vying for it, and Castro won. You know, when Mao was fighting, there were a whole lot of cats vying with him, and he won. And that inside all movements, you have that. You have people who vie, and organizations that vie, and that the one who has the doctrine that most people listen to are the one they adhere to. I think what it represents, though, in this day and age, and started certainly with Malcolm X, is that black people will pick their leaders and that they will no longer allow white people to pick them. See, what white folks didn't understand was they gave us a big help when they blasted black power. When they all blasted it, black folk knew it must be good. Had to be good. And so I just think that that's part of it.
Way back over there underneath the eaves there. That you're right there. The question was, why not have the radicals take over the liberals in an established party rather than creating a third party?
Precisely in the Democratic Party. That's the theory the old socialists had. They used to call it realignment, that they would get into the Democratic Party and push it further left and gain control. Now, an inspection of history in this country inside the Democratic Party proves that that's just impossible. that what usually happens is that those people themselves become co-opted. And that, in fact, if you're going to develop a real movement in this country, what you have to do is to draw the lines real tight, see, so that the liberals will pick sides. And that if the conservatives are controlled, it just means the line is really drawn tight. So you can see if, in fact, the liberals who mouth liberalism are really liberals, or, in fact, conservatives who mouth liberalism. The second thing is that before you can gain control, you've got to break the backs of the Democratic Party, and that we aim to try to do that, to break the back of the Democratic Party in this country, and that we can effectively do that, whether we're 10% or not, because in 62, 63, this country reapportioned itself, vesting the powers within the urban areas of the country, and that's where we are. That's where we are. And that we can begin to develop that independent political force to just split the party wide open, wherever it is. And that given the discontent of radicals, maybe they will begin to do the same thing and a real movement can develop. Also, because we do not believe that a two-party system is the best type of system to maintain a democracy, we have to fight for more parties. So you've got to fight for independent parties. See, our major assumption would say that we do not agree that the two-party system is the best system. Your assumptions already accept that the two-party system is the best way.
The question is for Mr. Carmel to explain what role he played in the riots, quote unquote, in Atlanta last summer.
It was both an active and a passive role, but the passive role was more powerful. See, when the rebellion broke out, cause a white cop shot a black youth. See, we went over and we told black people, you don't have to tolerate this anymore. Let us protest. So the white police... So the white police, when they heard that we were going to protest, came out with their machine guns, and they brought out their armed guards with their helmets, and they got the people, more upset. And they started to issue orders, and the people had just had enough. So they started to riot. Now, I was right in the middle of it. Didn't throw a rock, didn't throw a brick, stood right by the policeman and said very nicely, if you want to stop this, take your cracker cops out of here. It'll stop. But they didn't listen. Oh, they just kept ordering, so the whole thing went. Then they arrested me for inciting to riot, put me into it. Now, here's where my passive role became important, because when I was in jail, that's when they really started to riot. They had these signs saying, get SNCC people out of jail or we will really tear up the city. And it spread to the next side. So they came running into jail and begged me to get out. And I told them, hell no. They had a $10,000 bond on me and the progressive racist and his lackeys in, and they dropped the charge of inciting to riot 3 days after I was in jail. Your good news media didn't tell you that. And to save face, they charged me with something called rioting. Well, now that's just what we wanted, because I wanted to get these white folks on a charge like that. Because you see, after every major rebellion in these cities, what happens is that when they finally quieted down the natives, they come running in and they pick up any native they see, because we all look alike. And they arrest us for rioting. See, and rioting is a very vague term. So when I got out, I brought an injunction against the city of Atlanta called Carmichael versus Ivan Allen et al. Et al. Is for the other racist. And we just won that injunction, which means that the 90 people that they arrested in the rebellion, they must let loose scot-free. And that the charge, that case now sets a precedent. It means that during a rebellion, when the police go in to arrest somebody, they cannot arrest them for rioting. They must say, Mr. Jones threw a brick, or Mr. Johnson beat up a policeman. They must have specific acts so they can't have their mass concentration camp. The newspapers didn't say that, but you can write to Atlanta and ask them for the case. They lost it. They should foot the bill. It's called Carmichael versus Allen et al. Just handed down by a three-panel federal court.
Okay. We still have time for some more. Okay, over there.
You haven't got the balcony at all. They're going to get mad at you.
Oh, well, next time. I think the gist of that is to appeal to sympathetic white people in this movement.
No, the question is, can't I perceive of why I want to wear the correct
that, that's slide. Right.
The question is that, don't I perceive of some white people who believe that I should get what rightfully is mine, and if I do, why do not I appeal to them? Because when one builds a movement, one appeals to one's people, not to groups in the oppressing camp. Clearly. Clearly. That's number one. If groups in the oppressing camp get upset, that's their problem, because if they believe in what you're doing, then they can support that program. But now, secondly, I do not think that white people can help me get what is rightfully mine. I think they can move into the white community to stop them from denying me what is rightfully mine. There's a big difference. White people can't give me freedom. They could only stop exploiting me. So that we urge white people who say they believe in our program to move into white society and help civilize it. And that is also important because of the psychological impact it has on blacks. See, there is nowhere in this country where a black man is in a position of power to do things by himself and stick his tongue out at white folk like Powell used to do. So that wherever we are in positions of power, there's always somebody white over us pulling the strings. So black children are always asking the question, can black people do those same things alone, by themselves, without white people showing them how? We're interested in our generation that's coming up. We don't ever want them to question their ability to rule themselves or to do anything white people can do. Therefore, we're going to do it for them. We will be their heroes. No more George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. SNCC's going to be their heroes.
Okay, up here. All right. What plan of action have you hypothesized in the urban cities, accomplish our basic plan of action?
We've just outlined here philosophically the concept under which we're going to move to do that. SNCC, you know, when we started SNCC in 1960, we sat down and looked at the country. The interest, the power in terms of population number was vested in the rural areas of this country, not in the cities. So we started to plot out the rural black areas of the South where our numbers were powerful so that we could fight for the right to vote. After having won the right to vote, then you could fight to vote the way you want to vote. Understand that. In 62, 63, while we were building political bases in the South, the country reapportioned itself, shifting the power to the urban areas where we are. We did not leave the South because we wanted to continue building our bases. Now we have those bases and we're broadening them, and we're now slowly moving to the North so that around this concept we'll begin to develop those. And we've tried that in Philadelphia. We're trying to develop independent political parties and independent candidates in Chicago. We're beginning to push that idea and up along the West Coast. But we're moving to take over those areas where we can independently. But our eyes are aimed for 1972. Because that's Bobby versus Humphrey and Lindsey versus Reagan, and while they're split, we can work out. 1 more.
One more question here. Ernie, we've been down there. Let's try this bank over here, right in the front on the balcony there. Since the advent of black power, what economic effect or how has this increased or decreased the budget of SNCC? And then you go into the appeal of liberal white money in the same area.
Well, let me first say that curtailment has been great. That white people has just stopped. That answers the first question. And the second question was?
If, what was the second question? I'm sorry, I can't remember your second.
Why?
Oh, yeah, right. Why just then? Okay. We have a political philosophy that we advocate. We think that political philosophy is sound. We then advocate it to anybody who's willing to listen to it and is willing to help support it, period. And we would hope that people who agree with that would then start moving. I mean, our message always to white liberals is that if you really believe that, you have to move into your community to develop institutions of power that will combat racism. Because on the question of racism, white society is a monolithic structure. Now, if you're really liberals, as you say you are, you will develop institutions to split. Didn't I ask you a question? Oh, if they want to give, we take money from anybody. I beg your pardon? Oh, no, on the contrary. We move deeper into the black community. But that, you know, if we can get money from anybody, we just take it because we need it, you know. And we move harder into the black community, noting the problems that we have to develop that community. Okay? I guess that's it. Thank you.